Well, we've worked through the prophecy of Micah together. Tonight I want to bring some threads together from the book and to consider the closing verses. If there's one thing that we've seen as we've gone through this book, it's this, that Micah lived through terrible times. Micah was a prophet to the people of Judah and Jerusalem, but he was also looking further afield to Israel and Samaria, and everywhere that Micah looked, he saw the same thing. He saw that he was living in a society that had become a cesspit, a horrible society, a society where evil seemed to be triumphing on every side. Jerusalem, outwardly, was a little better than Samaria, but there was no real difference between them. He says that at the very opening of the book. Jerusalem, Samaria, there's no difference, he says. They're both horrible. They're both sick. It's the picture he uses in the first chapter where he says the wound of Samaria is incurable and now it's come to Judah. It's a society sick to death. It's a society where everything good is draining away. It's horrible. Horrible to watch. Horrible to live in such a society. Living there where he does, Micah has seen the depths of human wickedness. He's had the opportunity to see what human beings are really like inside, and it leaves him feeling sick. He's seen idolatry. He talks about that in chapter 1, verse 7. People turning away from the true, living, holy God, and then deliberately bowing down to worship bits of stone and wood, carrying them about in processions, talking about these things as if they're worth worshipping. That shocks Micah. The people who know about the real God should be so stupid, so blind, so deliberately blind as to start worshipping idols. It's horrible. It's insane. It's just an insult to the real God. Micah hates to see that. He talks about prostitution in verse 7 of chapter 1. I think he means that at two levels. On the one side, he says the whole nation is like a prostitute. It's prepared to go anywhere, do anything for the sake of financial advantage. But it's not just that, it's happening physically within the nation. The other prophets describe how the women of Samaria and Jerusalem were so happy to prostitute themselves. When Micah's walking through the streets, he's seeing these painted women everywhere. And it horrifies him. He knows what marriage is supposed to be. A pure and beautiful relationship between a man and a woman. But these people are turning away from that to these sordid, empty relationships that aren't relationships. He sees greed everywhere. Talks in chapter 2, verse 2, about how people just covet fields and then seize them. They see houses that they like and then take them away from their real owners. He talks about oppression in chapter 2, verse 2 again. They oppress a man and his house, a man and his inheritance. They just crush the weak and the vulnerable underfoot. They just don't care who they hurt. He's seen how stubborn they are. When he tries to talk to them, they refuse to listen. Chapter 2, verse 6. Do not preach. Thus they preach. One should not preach of such things. He's talking to people who are always ready to listen to any bizarre, twisted new idea, but who are absolutely stubborn when it comes to the truth that Micah is preaching. They just don't want to hear it. He talks about their ruthlessness. In chapter 2, verse 8, lately my people have risen up as an enemy. You strip the rich robe from those who pass by trustingly, with no thought of war. The women of my people you drive out from their delightful houses, and from their young children you take away my splendor forever. There's no one who was so weak, so young, that they were safe there in that society. It was the sort of society where people would exploit and rob children. The sort of society where children become the prey of ruthless, greedy men. It's a society that was becoming more and more given over to drunkenness. Chapter 2, verse 11. If a man should go about and utter wind and lie, saying, I'll preach to you about wine and strong drink, he'd be the preacher for this people. Because people thought it was great to get drunk. Drunkenness is disgusting. You know, to walk down a road in Manchester late at night, perhaps not that late at night, to see people lying in the gutter in their own vomit. It's disgusting to see people just giving themselves over to abandon. Micah had to see scenes like that in the streets of Jerusalem. It's disgusting. It's horrible. He talks about inhumanity, how inhumane people became, how they just didn't care about one another as people or put any value on human life at all. Chapter 3, you who hate, this is verse 2, you who hate the good and love the evil, you tear the skin from off my people. You tear their flesh from off their bones. You eat the flesh of my people. You flay their skin from off them and break their bones in pieces and chop them up like meat in a pot, like flesh in a cauldron. Utter inhumanity. They just see one another as commodities to be devoured. He talks about the corruption that was there in every level of society. Chapter 2, verse 9. Hear this, you heads of the house of Jacob, rulers of the house of Israel, who detest justice and make crooked all that's straight. In verse 11, it's the rulers who accept bribes. It's the priests who teach what they're paid to teach. The prophets who practice divination for money. Corrupt society where money buys everything but nothing has any value. Society full of bloodshed. Verse 10, you build Zion with blood and Jerusalem with iniquity. Every day, stories about innocent people hacked to bits, about people being murdered randomly, about people being killed in the course of robbery. Wonder how many people how many of Micah's friends and acquaintances have been killed in Jerusalem. Arrogance. That was one of the most frightening things. That in the midst of this disintegrating society, with its drunkenness and its orgies and its robbery and its murders, what were people saying? It's there in verse 11 of chapter 3. They lean on the Lord and say, "Is not the Lord in the midst of us? No disaster shall come upon us." That's such arrogance, such complacency. It's sickening. Micah found it sickening. How could they talk like that? How can they spit in God's face? How can they ignore all God's commands? How can they just trample all God's laws underfoot and then say, "Oh, but God's going to protect us"? Such blindness, such arrogance. He saw the deceit, the lies of people in that society. The fact that none of them had the slightest concern about telling the truth. Talks about it in chapter 6. Verse 12, "Your rich men are full of violence, your inhabitants speak lies, their tongue is deceitful in their mouth." Horrible. Horrible to live in a disintegrating sick society. A society that's rejected God. A society that's been handed over to wickedness. A society that's spiralling further and further, quicker and quicker, down into filth and horror. Some of you, as we've gone through this book of Micah, have said, "That's our society." Almost every word of Micah's description could have been written about UK 2013. And it's horrible. It is really horrible. It's horrible to see the way people live. It's horrible to read the reports in the papers. It's horrible when you see a neighbouring house boarded up and taped off, and people shrug their shoulders and say, "Oh, it's just another murder just down the road." Horrible when those things become commonplace. Horrible to know of the pornography, the abuse of children in our society. Horrible to know that it's a society built on the murder of 200,000 unborn babies every year. Horrible when vile perversions are normalized and actually sanctified by the state. Horrible. Micah found it horrible, and Micah found it hard to cope with. We've seen that, haven't we? We've heard Micah's cries of despair in this book, his outcries of horror. Do you remember in chapter 1, verse 8, he says, "For this I will lament and wail. I'll go stripped and naked. I'll make lamentation like the jackals and mourning like the ostriches." He says, "I just feel like howling all day. I just can't cope with it," says Micah. Says it again in chapter 7. "Woe is me." He says, "I am just so wretched. Woe is me. For I've become as when the summer fruit has been gathered. As when the grapes have been gleaned. There's no cluster to eat." He says, "I'm starving. Why? Because, chapter 7, verse 2, the godly has perished from the earth. There's no one upright among mankind. They all lie in wait for blood. They hunt one another with a net, and their hands are on what is evil. He says, oh, woe is me. He says, I just hate it. It's tearing me to bits living in a society like this. It's dangerous living in a society like this. For a believer, it's dangerous. It's dangerous because of what it can do to us emotionally. It's dangerous because it can drive us to despair. It can drive us into depression. Deep depression. Depression where we're almost paralyzed. It can drive us into apathy, where we just feel it's not worth doing anything. The only thing to do is to retreat and hide away with our head in our hands and our hands over our ears. It's dangerous emotionally living in a society like this. There are points in this book where you feel that Micah is near a breakdown. Woe is me. I'm just running around wailing like a jackal. He says it. And yet that isn't the last note of the book, is it? How does Micah come to terms with living in the society he lives in, with the misery that it causes him? Three things that I think you can see in Micah breaking through all the darkness, all the misery. First of all, despite everything, he is confident. He's confident because God's punishment is sure. He comes back to that again and again. He looks at all the wickedness of the society around him. And it seems to be out of control. It seems that people are getting away with everything. And he says, but God will deal with these people. God will act in justice. God will punish the wicked. I can be confident of that. Behold, the Lord is coming out of his place. He will come. He won't just sit there watching all this happen. He will come. And he'll tread upon the high places of the earth. And the mountains will melt under him. And the valleys will split open like wax before the fire, like waters pour down a steep place. This is for the transgression of Jacob, for the sins of the house of Israel. I will make Samaria, says the Lord, a heap in the open country. Those carved images shall be beaten to pieces. Those dishonestly gained wages shall be burned with fire. God will act. God will punish. Says it. Again, in that day, declares the Lord, I will cut off your horses from among you. I will destroy your chariots. I will cut off the cities of your land. I will throw down all your strongholds. I will cut off the sorceries. You shall have no more tellers of fortunes. I will cut off your carved images and your pillars from among you. I'll act, says the Lord. Micah is confident of that. We don't rejoice at the thought of wicked sinners being trampled down by God, being burned up under his judgment. We don't rejoice in the thought of a rebellious people being cast into hell, but we do rejoice in the fact that God is just and that God is going to punish evil. I could not love a God who stands back and simply allows perversion and cruelty to go unpunished. It's one of the most precious things for us as believers, one of the things for which we worship God, the fact that he hates sin and that he has sworn to punish sin. Now I read through the newspapers, they're full of stories of unchecked, unpunished wickedness. But the last issue of the newspaper has not yet come out. And the last issue is the one that says, God will send his son from heaven. God sends his son to punish the wicked. So Micah has that confidence. If he didn't have that confidence, he would sink into despair. He would have his breakdown. But he has that confidence. God's punishment is sure. And then he has something further. Micah has a great assurance. An assurance that God's plan will be accomplished. Again and again. At times when Micah has painted the darkest picture, Micah has raised his eyes and said, but God has a great plan for the future. And God's plan will be accomplished. It shall come to pass in the latter days that the mountain of the house of the Lord shall be established as the highest of the mountains. It shall be lifted up above the hills, and people shall flow to it, and many nations shall come and say, come, let's go to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob, that he may teach us his ways, that we may walk in his paths. That's the plan of the Lord. A world delivered from sin. A world in which there'll be no more violence. A world in which people from all nations will worship God in spirit and in truth. A world redeemed, rescued by the Christ. Micah has caught a glimpse of Jesus coming. He shall stand and shepherd his flock in the strength of the Lord, in the majesty of the name of the Lord his God. And they shall dwell secure, for he shall be great to the ends of the earth. He shall be their peace. Oh yeah. If Micah looks at the society around him, then he's going to tear out his hair and he's going to say, it's all out of control. But when he looks at God's plan, he says, nothing's out of control. God is working towards that great and glorious and infallible end. He's going to build that city that has foundations, the city whose streets are paved with gold, that city where there is no need for a temple, for God himself is in the midst. He's going to rescue the universe. He's going to restore man. Micah's got that utter assurance. God's plan will be accomplished. So there's confidence. Sin will be punished. There's assurance God's plan will be accomplished. But then the third thing that we see breaking through the darkness again and again is this. Amazement. Amazement that God's forgiveness is free. And that's the note with which Micah ends his prophecy. These last verses of Micah chapter 7, what are they? They are a cry of amazement, of awe, of wonder. God forgives sinners, and his forgiveness is free. He's looked into the heart of man. He's seen how utterly evil human beings are, how utterly evil human society is. But in the end, that doesn't drive him to depression. It drives him to amazed wonder. It drives him to admire the God who can save sinful human beings. It leaves him saying, this is amazing. If this is what human beings are like, this is amazing that God could love human beings like that. And God saves human beings like that. God forgives human beings like that. Who is a God like you, pardoning iniquity, passing over transgression for the remnant of his inheritance? The more clearly that we see human wickedness, the more it's exposed before our eyes, the more amazed we should be by the gospel, the more amazed and thrilled we should be by grace. Where sin abounded, grace much more abounded. Micah, because he had seen how wicked human beings were, he could be amazed at a God who will save human beings like that. Here's his cry of amazement in verse 18. Who is a God like you? He thought about what human beings are like. But now it's, who is a God like you? Against this dark background, the glory, the greatness, the grace of God was shining so brightly in Micah's eyes. Who is a God like you? What is it that makes God's grace so wonderful for Micah? Let me just point out four things very briefly in these verses, verses 18 to 20. First of all, God's grace is wonderful to Micah because of the sin that God pardons. Here in these verses, Micah piles up words to show how horrible human sin is. He talks about iniquity. And the word means twistedness. Something that is unnatural and perverted and horrible and sick. And then he talks about transgression. And the word means deliberate disobedience. It means people going flatly against God's commands. He talks about sins in verse 19. And the word carries the force of rebellion, rebelliousness. All these different words to express the fact that there is something gross about human sin. What are human beings? They're people who are twisted, perverted, that they're completely out of shape morally. There's something horrible, diseased about them. What are human beings? They're people who are deliberately breaking God's commands. Whether those commands they know from a book or whether they know those commands because they're written on their conscience, they are people who are deliberately smashing God's laws. The people who are rebels. They're people who are shaking off the authority of God. They're people with whom God is angry and with whom God has reason to be angry. That's the word that he uses in the second half of verse 18. He talks about God's anger. There's something about human wickedness that makes God enraged. He looks at it and he says, I'm furious about it. God was looking at what was happening in Jerusalem, what was happening in Samaria, and the fury rose in God's heart. That's what sin does. That's what sin is. And that's why it's amazing that God has found a way to forgive sin. People think that the things they've done wrong are trifling little peccadilloes, little faults. God doesn't look at them that way. Micah didn't see them that way. Micah saw human sin as gross and horrible. Yet he says, who's a God like you? You're willing to forgive sins. Secondly, in these verses, what makes God's grace so amazing is the love that he shows. When God forgives sins, it's not just a mechanical transaction. It's a display of love. In verse 19, Micah talks about God's compassion. God looks on wicked people, twisted people, rebellious people, and he feels anger towards them. He's right to be angry with them. But along with that, he feels compassion. He looks at the prostitute strutting on the street corner. He says, I feel so sorry for her. He looks at the miser piling up his gold. And he says, I feel so sorry for that man. He looks at the people bowing down before their idols. And he says, oh, I pity them. God pities sinners. Although it's him they're attacking. Although it's him they're blaspheming, although it's his laws they're trampling under, although they're making him angry, at the same time, he can feel pity. And it's his pity that drives him to find a way of saving them. And then when he has saved them, Micah uses a different word for the love he has for them. He delights in steadfast love. That having once felt that pity for them, and having once then found a way of saving them and forgiving them, God loves them with a steadfast love that will never change. He takes hold of the wretched, disgusting creature, and he says, having begun to love this person, I'm going to love him forever. I'm never going to let him go. God's faithful to him. You'll show faithfulness to Jacob. God's love is amazing. Why is God's grace so amazing? Firstly, because of the scale of the sins that he pardons. Secondly, because of the extraordinary love he shows. Thirdly, because of the reasons he gives. Why does God show grace? Why does God pardon sinners? Look at one phrase. It's the third line of verse 18. Who is a God like you, pardoning iniquity and passing over transgression for the remnant of his inheritance? The remnant. That's a very important word in the Old Testament. God's anger poured out. God's anger punishing sinners. And yet there comes a point to which God says, I am not going to destroy them all. because I have chosen these people. They're the remnant. They're the people whom I'm going to spare. They'd be no different from anyone else, but they're the remnant I've chosen. This is about God's choice. That he looks at people who are just as wicked as anyone else, and he says, they're the remnant. They're the people I have chosen. They're the people on whom I have set my love. He calls them my inheritance, the remnant of his inheritance. He says, I've decided that these people are going to belong to me. It's pure sovereignty. It's a God who says, they deserve to be punished as much as anyone else. But I've decided to make them mine. I've decided that they're going to be precious to me. It's all in accordance with his plan. It's there in verse 20. You will show faithfulness to Jacob and steadfast love to Abraham, as you've sworn to our fathers from the days of old. These are the reasons God gives for forgiving sinners. Not that these sinners are better than others. Not that they've done something to win forgiveness. Not that they deserve anything, but simply that he's chosen them, and that he's set his love on them, and that he's going to fulfill his plan for them. And then fourthly, what's so amazing about God's grace? The security he gives. Isn't it lovely? Verse 19, he will again have compassion on us. He will tread our iniquities underfoot. You will cast all our sins into the depths of the sea. They're gone. Once he has forgiven, he's forgiven forever. There's no dredging those sins out from the bottom of the Mindanao Trench. They're wiped out, wiped from the record. They're drowned in the sea. They're buried where no one can ever dredge them up again. The man, the woman, the child whom God has forgiven is safe, safe forever. They have total security because God has taken all their sins and cast them away where they'll never be found, where they'll never be seen again. This is God's grace, and it's amazing. It's amazing that he takes twisted, wicked human beings and forgives them. It's amazing that he feels pity for them and finds a way of dealing with their sin and then loving them forever. It's amazing that he chooses them and that he makes them his inheritance. It's amazing that he has this plan, which was drawn up before the world was even made. It's amazing that once he's saved somebody, he keeps them safe forever. And it's amazing the price he was willing to pay to do all this. I can't close the page on Micah without pointing you to Jesus. Micah has spoken earlier about the Messiah who is our peace. It's through that Messiah. It's through Jesus. It's through a blood-stained cross that this forgiveness was bought. That's the price.